Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. It is true crime time. And as you know, November is anniversary month for the site. And so I've been, you know, rehashing some of my favorite things to talk about and old things and doing it on the podcast and stuff. And it's no different with Jen. We are going to talk about one of Jen's favorite cases, or white whales, if you will. But this one's really important to you, isn't it?
It is. It's definitely in my top 10.
And I know you like, see, this is where it's different, because I know you like unidentified. Those are like the big ones that you really like. But this one, we don't have anything, right? So.
We don't. There's so many coincidences and so many different paths that you can take in this case. It's what makes it so just mysteriously, I don't want to say interesting, because it's tragic in the fact that, you know, our character is missing, but it is definitely something, it'll work your mind out.
Can I ask you this? Let me ask you this. It seems as if, and maybe it's just because, you know, I've only looked at it a little bit, but that there's actually, unlike most disappearances, that there actually have been clues over the years. That you don't usually see in missing cases.
That's why it's in my top 10, is because my top 10 also includes Delphi. Sometimes we get clues and they just don't help steer us any deeper into an investigation, let's say persuasion, that helps us understand any more about what happened. You know, Delphi, we have video. Missy Bevers, we have video. In this case, there is items that will be recovered. You think that they would serve as a treasure trove of knowledge, but actually, no.
So we were talking about Aisha Degree, and, you know, she went missing on Valentine's Day, which is awful. I can't believe we haven't talked about it in one of our Valentine's Day episodes, you know, because we always find people who've disappeared on Valentine's Day, and we haven't talked about her.
Yeah, she's a February 14th, 2000 case, and basically the FBI, they continue to follow this case, and they've done updated renderings because she was 9 years old when she disappeared. They've done updates on what she might look like today, and they've released those. And I've always just kind of waited back on the FBI to make progress in this case and maybe release some information on the items they recovered, because they are holding back, definitely. And they just haven't released anything. So I figure we just go ahead and introduce the case, at least to the audience that doesn't know about it. And then hopefully something will break.
Yeah. So her parents, Harold and Akia, they went to wake her for school, but she was nowhere to be found. And essentially, investigators heard from a couple of people that they saw a girl walking along this kind of like, it's North Carolina 18, but I'm imagining it's probably like a one lane highway each way.
You have a little girl, right? She's 9 years old. She's supposed to be in her bed at night. It is a night of unfortunate events. You know, it's pouring down rain. It's a pitch black dark at night. You know, she's just a little kid. Her parents believe that she is sleeping in her bedroom, or that's what the parents lead us to believe. And then you have this highway that she goes on to be spotted walking along. This highway is desolate. There is no lighting outside of just the headlights that would be hitting any person that was walking on foot.
And investigators said that maybe why she left home before dawn was that she was upset over a performance in a basketball game. But I guess we should go back to the night before, right? So
yeah, February 13th is going to be one of the most important days.
Because that was a Sunday. So February 14th that year, Valentine's Day was on a Monday. So February 13th is a Sunday. The children went to church, but they went from a relative's house, right? So they hadn't spent the night at their own house.
Yeah. So, you know, Aisha's parents, they live across the street from at least one relative, and then have other relatives in the vicinity. So these people live very close together. And then outside of that, they have family also in the Atlanta area, because they had recently attended a family reunion. So, Aisha's coming off of this family reunion thing, and then she's at church with relatives. So family is a big part of her life, and she doesn't really have a lot of friends outside of school and this family dynamic or her church, because she is a very sheltered child. And I just cannot even express how sheltered she was almost to the point of, in my opinion, suffocation. You know, her parents just did not have outsiders, meddling in their kids' lives. They are just very, very protective.
Very protective. And that comes to light when you realize that there's like no computer in the house and stuff. But so they leave from the relative's house to go to church. But then after church, they come home to their own house. And around 8 p.m. that night, both children went to bed in the room they shared. So she shares a room with somebody. And then an hour later, the power went out of the neighborhood after a nearby car accident. So you have this rain, right, or the cold, and then now you have no power. And the power came on around 12:30 in the morning. And I guess the dad went and checked on his children at 12:30 and saw them again. And the guy stays up late. I mean, he stays up super late.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who works the night shift. So what had happened was there was this really bad storm that hit the area. And at the same time, the storm's going on simultaneously. A motorist hits a power pole. It affects the power in Aisha's community. And, you know, it changes the family's routine. There's no bath because, you know, you can't turn the lights on to see, things like that. So the mother, Aquila, changes the entire routine. This sets up, you know, Aisha's night to be, I don't know, it just becomes very puzzling from here, because once the lights do come back on, the father's still at work. Like I said, he works the night shift, so he comes in very, very late. You know, it's not abnormal for him to come in at 1:45, 2 in the morning. He said that he peeked in on them around 2:30 a.m., you know, both children, Aisha's sleeping with in the same room as her brother. And I want to believe that they're close in age. You know, I think the brother's a little bit older, but they're close enough in age to where that situation still works.
Yeah, I think that he was 10 at the time. So 9 and 10, definitely close in age. So the dad said that afterwards, so he goes in 2:30. And remember, we have somebody saying that she was on the highway at 4. So, but he said that I guess it was the son, right? The one, he heard the bed squeak or something like that. But he didn't rouse himself at all. The brother, he said that he thought, oh, well, she's just changing positions in her sleep. But instead, she got out of bed.
Yeah, it's an interesting statement, because you have a brother and a sister sharing a room. Okay, the room is not that large. So he said that he heard her bed squeak, but he refused, in his mind, to turn over and face like whatever was happening, which, you know, in my mind, in investigator mind, you have red flags, right? So you just have to investigate why he would not want to turn over and view whatever was going on. You normally tell your sister, hey, you know, pipe it down over there, I'm trying to sleep. But he said that it immediately quit. You know, did it? Because this little girl goes on to leave her home, take a backpack, take items with her. To me, that's a lot of noise, a lot of disturbance going on in this tiny room. And for him not to observe it or not to say anything about it or to act like he slept through it is going to just be really concerning to me. And I definitely want to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, so the brother's name is O'Brien. And here's what, okay. Let's say he didn't want it. I'm going to just give the benefit of the doubt here for a second. I know exactly where you're going with the other thought. But let's just say that he didn't want to turn over, because then if he turned over, then they'd have the conversation, then he wouldn't be able to go back to sleep or something. That's one possibility. I know where you're going with the other possibility, and that's like, only bad things happen when I look over there when she's in bed. And because somebody has told me not to look over there. And so I don't.
Yeah, because that's come up in other cases, you know. So I wonder what was going on over there, really, to where, you know, the child would rather look away. Or, you know, was it a case of where he really just could not be bothered? He's just so sleepy and, you know, he just doesn't want to deal with his sister. That could be a thing. But again, it's like it's 2 a.m. This family is up, you know, the dad's up. He's running around trying to get ready for not only Valentine's Day, but Aquila and this man, it's their anniversary, their marriage right. anniversary. So it's important to him. He says he's running out to the store to get, you know, gifts for the occasion. So he's up. We know that Aisha's up because she goes on to leave the house. The brother is up because he at least heard her turn over.
So let's say it was a situation where he just wanted to go back to sleep. At this point, then that theory goes out the window, because He is going to, he's 10. He's got to be, you know, I'm assuming, you know, at least a year older, just based on the math. But the, she starts packing items. Yes, I know that she had packed a book bag with several sets of clothes and personal items, but he's going to hear all this and she's not going to be able to do it completely in the dark. He's going to turn over and go, what the hell are you doing? It's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly. You know? And they had a power outage earlier, right? And it was for a couple of hours. So at what point in time did this little girl start packing her bag? Because you could argue, well, maybe she pre-packed. Okay. But at what point in time? Because she did have a basketball game, but the night before, right? The day before or the night before, and she packs her basketball jersey. So at what point did she start packing this bag? Was it once she got home on, you know, Saturday from a game, or was it literally that Sunday? And if it was Sunday, then how did the brother miss her packing? And, you know, again, is she doing this in the dark?
Yeah, that is the strange part. And then, so then you have, you know, I said 4 a.m. before, but it was between 3:45 and 4:15. And a truck driver and a motorist saw her walking south along the highway. First of all, motorists stop, pick the child up. It is between 3:45 and 4:15 in the morning, and she's walking alone along a highway.
Yeah, first, you know, it's pouring down rain still. So they saw her because she was wearing all white, and that is just we'll get into how that's just weird all by itself. But, you know, it's dark at night. She's wearing all white. Some people thought that it was just a small woman, and they did not approach her because they thought it was either a motorist with car trouble or a woman who was escaping a domestic violence situation. So it was mostly truck drivers passing her. And while the truck drivers did report the activity through their CB radio to each other, to other truckers, no one called law enforcement. Like, no one dialed 911 and said, hey, there's a woman on the road in the rain. That didn't happen.
Now, there was one motorist who said that, hey, it looked strange. And, you know, I tried to circle around, but then the kid, you know, ran off into the woods. Okay, I get that the kid would try and run off into the woods because the motorist is coming by and she's led a very protective life or whatever. But there's just, you know, you got to stop right then. And even if the child runs into the woods or whatever, great, stay away from the child or whatever so you don't freak her out. But you got to call somebody. This is not, you know, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning on the way to school. This is between 3:45 and 4:15 in the morning, and it's pouring rain. There is no logical explanation for why the child would be out there.
Yeah, it's very suspicious, but people, they have the mentality of they don't want to get involved. So, because they're not real sure what they're seeing. You know, they're like, well, maybe if I'm reported, you know, I don't know enough information about it. You know, maybe it's someone who lives around here. Maybe they're ducking into their own backyard. You know, I just don't know enough to get involved. So we'll give those people the benefit of the doubt, but they don't call it in. The reports only start trickling in after Aisha's missing poster goes up and the news starts broadcasting, you know, to the public, have you seen this child? Then truckers and the motorists reach out and say, hey, yeah, we saw her.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people saw her. And the sheriff said, yeah, I think everybody was right because they knew what she was wearing and the direction that she was headed. Everybody said the same thing. So it just...
So these are good witnesses. This is a case where we know for just... I want to say we know for a fact that between at least 3:45 and 4:15, somewhere in that window, this child was on that highway 18. She just absolutely was.
And, you know, it's sometimes people can do things where bad things don't happen. And I wonder if it wasn't so rainy that if somebody would have tried a little bit harder, but they're like, I don't want to get out in the cold and the wet and it's, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning and it's none of my business. And if it would have been a different response if it hadn't been raining.
Well, also, you know, they didn't want to be accused of chasing someone, especially if it was a child, into the woods, because that can get turned around on you so quickly and it can look like that you're the kidnapper and you are the one causing the disturbance. You know, who knows what the person that you're pursuing will say. You know, will they feel like that you victimized them? You know, I'm not going to chase somebody into the woods. You know, phoning it into authorities is definitely the thing to do. But so we have her on the highway, but, you know, you talk about how the little girl she's scared of motorists and stuff. But then again, you have to play devil's advocate. She's not so scared that she didn't leave her house, you know, after packing a bag It's pouring down rain. They didn't say she was carrying a flashlight or anything like that. It's dark out there, and yet she's navigating far away from her home. So she's not too scared, right?
No. You know, she's not. Here's the other thing. It is such a sheltered house, such a close-knit house. I find it really hard to believe that the parents couldn't pick up on the fact that she was going to run away or leave or be upset. I get the feeling, especially when you hear them talking, like the FBI has recorded some videos with the parents still, and you hear them talking, it's kind of strange to me that they didn't pick up on that signal.
The one thing they talk about is that, that weekend, the little girl's basketball team lost, and she took it really hard. I don't know if it was due to a play that she personally did not perform well, or if it was just the team as a whole, but she cried. She was very emotional, just publicly emotional. So they knew that she took it hard, but her brother played a game right after hers, and it seemed like that she was in a better spirit after his game was over. And, her own basketball coach was joking with her and, playing around with other teammates and stuff like that. And it seemed like the little girl came around at that point. So the parents thought she was over it. But, in hindsight, they wonder if the situation was not still playing on, her mind. The fact they lost the game, maybe it was her fault. And did that cause her to take off?
I understand that, the kid is 9, but did the parents yell at her and berate her and say, you're the reason that they lost, we don't want anything to do with you? I don't think so.
No, I believe that they were handing out Valentine candy and telling them, there's always a next game. You win some, you lose some. No, it seemed to be a very supportive environment. Like I said, her own coach was joking around with her and like throwing a towel over her head and like playing peekaboo and stuff. He's like, get over it. You win some, you lose some. We'll move on. And then she seemed to at least publicly adopt that mentality also, like, okay, we'll get them next time. So the parents thought she was over it. Outside of her losing the basketball game, they could not come up with any other situation that would make her leave home, or at least they're not introducing any other situations to the FBI.
Yeah, I like how you put that. I have a question. So they went to bed at 8, and the power went out at 9. But mom gets up at 5:45 in the morning to get them ready for school, and also says, that they didn't have a bath because they hadn't been able to do it because of the power outage. But the power didn't go out until after they went to bed, so I don't get that so much.
Yeah, I don't understand the bath time routine getting skipped either. But, since they say it's a thing, we'll go with that. It's part of the timeline.
Yeah, I know. So she opens the children's room to wake them up before their 6:30 alarm and calls them to the bath. So I guess the brother and the sister take a bath together.
I hope not. Surely not, right? That seems like a red line. They're young, but they're not that young anymore. The bedroom thing, I understand, because they said that the children were so sheltered that their mentality was less than that of, let's say, 9 and 10. It's lower. But the bath thing, I don't know about that.
I'm just saying that the way that I've seen the statements, it seems like that they took a bath together. I don't know.
Yeah, I saw it too, and I questioned it highly. So I just wanted to put that out there that,
Yeah. So O'Brien was in his bed. Aisha was not. And the mom was unable to find her in the house or in the cars, which is interesting. Did the child usually go out and hide in the cars? And so she tells her husband, hey, I can't find Aisha. And he says, well, you know what? She might have gone over to my mom's house across the street. So,
let's pause right there. Because you have a little girl and they say that she would never leave that house. She would never, ever, ever, without our permission, without taking someone with her. She's terrified of the dark. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe she's over at a relative's house across the street. Okay, which one is it? This is where I say that the parents seem like good people, but there's just discrepancies that bother me, from a psychological point of view. Either your child is willing to leave the home in the dark, or she is not willing to leave the home in the dark. You see how they're playing both sides there.
they are playing both sides. And if she is willing to leave the house in the dark, then you go back to O'Brien and not really caring whether or not his sister's up and going out of the house at 4 o'clock in the morning, because perhaps she has done it before.
That's a good point.
You know, so perhaps he's just like, oh, she's just going to go over there and bug grandma or whatever. And it just, so, and I'm sure that they probably leave the doors unlocked. And so, you know, she can go over and go to grandma's house and just walk in the door.
Yeah. And, I mean, after all, Aisha, she leaves with a set of keys. So apparently each child has a set of keys to the home, which tells me they're allowing themselves to go in and out of the home, maybe as they please, but they're definitely going in and out of the home without the parents accompanying them, or they wouldn't need keys.
Right. And so Aisha's mom calls over to grandma, and it's, she actually talks to what would be Aisha's aunt, who's also lives there, and says, oh no, she's not here. And so there's a lot of family members living across the street. And so then the mom says, that's when I went into panic mode and I heard a car next door. I put shoes on and I ran outside. And then she calls her own mother, who told her to call the police.
And yeah, so it seems like the family's nice. So far, they've done everything right. You know, the child's missing. They notify authorities immediately upon realizing that she's missing. And, you know, the whole family's on board and trying to locate her.
Yeah, I mean, she said that, you know, it's by 6:40, the police are there. And that's pretty fast. And then police dogs come, and they can't pick up her scent. I guess maybe because it had been raining when she left.
Yeah, I don't understand that, because usually rain makes the scent even more potent. So the dogs not picking up on it, you know, it's like an eyebrow raise for me. I'm like, whoa. Okay, well, we know she was out there because she was spotted on the highway by multiple people, but how did the dogs not know?
Was she put into a car and then dumped on the highway? I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me with the dogs, because, of course, they should get her scent because she was just there. You know? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's only been a couple of hours. They should have been hitting like crazy.
And, you know, the mom goes through the neighborhood. She's calling Aisha's name, and that everybody is up by 7, and the friends and the family, everybody's looking, and it's kind of, you know, they're searching the whole area. They get the church to come, and by day's end, they found a mitten, but mom said it didn't belong to her daughter, and that no winter clothing had been taken from the house. Now, February in North Carolina, we already know it's cold and rainy, but she didn't take any winter clothing or any kind of jacket?
Right. So they asked the mom to start itemizing the little girl's room until, you know, try to understand what the child took. And so she came up with a nice Valentine outfit. I think it was something red and white, you know, just really girly. And then the basketball jersey and, you know, things that she really loved. She took some family photos and, you know, some candy and stuff like that. Like, her mother knew what was missing. She is nosy enough in her kids' lives to realize what is missing from their bedroom.
Yeah, it just, but she didn't take a coat?
Apparently not. You know, that no one ever said anything about a flashlight or about a coat or a rain jacket or anything, because she went to sleep wearing all white, and then she's seen on the highway wearing all white. It really does seem like that she just walked out the front door either wearing her sleep attire or just wearing a lounge clothes, you know, that you would wear inside the home. She paid no attention to the fact that it is disgusting outside. It is pouring down rain. You know, she's supposedly terrified of thunderstorms and dogs. Yet on February 15th, you know, investigators are called to investigate some things that are found in a nearby shed just off of that highway that she was spotted on.
Yeah, I don't understand this at all, because some 9-year-old kid, middle of the night, that's scary enough, number one, to leave your house. Number two, it's freezing. Number three, it's pouring rain. Number four, you say, I don't need a coat. That is nuts to me. It is absolutely nuts.
It is, because
nuts.
You pack a bag, right? So it's anticipation. You're going somewhere for at least a little bit. You're going to stay because you need changes of clothes. You also take a family photo, because you're going to miss them, because, again, you're planning to be away for some time, yet you don't plan to take a coat to help support yourself being out that time. This is where child logic, you know, where they're missing the aspect, you know, the brain hasn't developed because, you know, she's packing her cute stuff, but she's not packing anything that she really honestly would need to pull off whatever it is here that is going on.
Okay. I totally get it. If it was just cold and not raining, I get it. She, the little kid's not thinking. She goes, it's, or, you know, if it's a pleasant enough day and she doesn't think about, oh, it's going to be freezing tonight or whatever, I don't need a coat. I get that. But it is pouring rain and cold. And as soon as she takes a step out of the house and gets dumped on by the rain, she's going to go, oh, I should be wearing a coat. Also, because I have a feeling that from her mom would probably never, ever let her walk out of the house if it was raining without a coat.
Exactly. And that brings me to a different type of mindset is this defiance. You have her doing a series of things that her mother would be mortified over, leaving the home, running away, not wearing a coat out in the rain. So if you try to follow that type of psychology, then it's a defiant child. But the parents, they will argue that she's never done anything like that. She's not that type of kid. But I'm here to tell you that kids can change their mindset overnight. They can become a different type of kid, literally just right before your eyes. So it just depends on what they're reading, what they're looking at, what they're inspired by, as to what changes them.
So as you said, the next day, there's this shed, and it's at a nearby business along the highway, kind of by where she'd been seen running into the woods. And they found candy wrappers, and also a pencil, a marker, and a Mickey Mouse-shaped hair bow that all were identified as belonging to her.
Yeah, the candy was handed out at the basketball game. The Mickey Mouse-shaped bow she was obsessed with. And then the pencil was something that not only her parents recognized, but also her teacher. So these items are found in a shed, sometimes that's referred to as a barn, the Turner's barn.
Okay.
And it seems like it's attached to an upholstery company. So it's a really odd place for the little girl to have discovered in the dark. And the thing is that her mom said she's scared of thunderstorms and dogs. And what backs up to this property is a kennel of dogs, like hunting dogs. And the neighbor says, how could the little girl have ever been in that shed? Because my dogs would have went crazy and they didn't bark not one time that night.
Yeah. See, that's kind of weird. So she runs, let's say that one of these drivers who saw that, hey, she went off into the woods. Let's say that checks out. So she runs into the woods and she runs through the woods and then she sees this building and she's just got to rest for a second or she's cold because she's not wearing a coat. But like you said, the dogs didn't bark or anything. And then the strangest thing that I find to all of this, is that there was a photograph that was also found of a black girl around her age who has yet to be identified.
Yeah, I think we need to make a point. Aisha is an African-American child, and they find another photo of an African-American child that is around the same age as Aisha in the shed. And despite posting the photo for the public to view, to this day, neither the FBI nor the public have been able to identify the child in the photo, which leads them to ask, is it a rendering, you know, like a fake photo that has just been manipulated, made for maybe portrait studios to sell photos to schools, you know, photo packages, because it looks like your typical school photo. You know, it's awkward looking and just, you know, it's those photos that we all hide once we get older.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, I don't, how many school photo companies could there be? So, you know, in this suburban Charlotte kind of area or even North Carolina. So you would think that, okay, well, let's check all the, you know, these school photo things and say, is this one of your photos? I think that would be really, really helpful.
And I'm sure that the feds did that. I'm sure they went through every, you know, studio company that has ever sold portrait packages to schools. They probably went through, you know, the different models they hired and then probably the different artists, you know, have you ever done a rendering that looks like this? To me, and the FBI has never came out and backed this statement up. They are very mum. You know, they tell you the gist. Here's the picture. Let us know if you've seen it and nothing further. I'm telling you, when I look at the photo, it looks kind of dated. It does not look as modern. You know, this was 2000, but it doesn't look as modern as one of Aisha's school photos. You know, when you look at hers, you know, they've got a look to it. You know, how mm-hmm. they're just dated as time goes on. This seems older.
Okay, so then we move to February 16th. And this is kind of, I don't know, to use, you know, your favorite word, hinky, is that the mom realizes that the bedroom was missing some of her favorite clothing, including a pair of blue jeans with the red stripe. And I don't know, I feel like mom would have gone in there, or somebody would have said, what do we think that she's wearing? And the mom would have gone and looked to see what was missing so she could say what she had been wearing, because she could say what she wore to bed, right? Because she put her to bed, but she can't be sure that that's what she was wearing the next day.
Well, yeah. And also they need to do an inventory of her room to find out how much material she packed into that bag. How long in her mind did she believe that she would be gone? You know, I don't know if her brain was like, she was nine, right? But her mother said that she was more of an immature mentality than nine. So I don't know if she knew how to pack ahead of time. So did she take, you know, two changes of clothes, three, four? Would it have even mattered? Did she even know what that meant? It just seems like she packed her bag with cute child things that she loved, her favorite jeans, her favorite top, her favorite photos, probably her favorite pencil and eraser, you know, the silly stuff that, like, as kids, we totally gravitate to.
So they searched for a week and 9,000 man hours. So, you know, that's a considerable number of people that were out there looking. And they searched about a 2 to 3 mile radius of where she had last been seen. I'm assuming that's the shed area probably, or are we talking, you know, next to the highway, whatever. It's somewhere over there rather than over by her house. And how far is the shed from her house?
It's not close, because they said that the school is a straight shot from where she was last seen, but it's literally like 35 miles away. So if she had been a school bus rider, she may have passed some of these places every single day riding the school bus, and that would be her familiarity with the area. Outside of that, people don't understand how she would navigate it, but I mean, it's a good walk for a nine-year-old. And as we get deeper into the story, the more things that are found, they are further away to where a child could not reach the areas on foot. You would now have a child that would need to be in a car.
So you have, as you said earlier, this was their anniversary, mom and dad's anniversary. They were married on Valentine's Day in 1988. Then O'Brien was born a year later, and then Aisha was born a year after that. So they're in a residential subdivision. I mean, it is rural, and it is on the western edge of the Charlotte metropolitan area. So maybe not a suburb, maybe more of an exurb, but it is not the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. It is just, you know, not hugely populated. And as you said before, the kids had keys. They're latchkey kids. And they let themselves in after school. And the parents said, hey, by the time we get home, you're going to be doing your homework or you're going to be finished with it. This is, you know, a very kind of, as you said, strict, controlling, you're going to do what we kind of say kind of house.
Yeah. I was just getting around the age of nine to where other kids are saying, well, what did you do this weekend? I went here, here, and here, and we got on, you know, maybe the computer or we did this, you know, we did pen pals, whatnot. And then Aisha's going, well, I'm not allowed to. Everything is, well, I'm not allowed to. I can't come, you know, rain check and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that will always make me wonder if that plays into the story, if it was like a smothering effect. I'm not saying her parents are not good parents. They seem fantastic because they are looking out for their kids, making sure that they have diligence in their schoolwork and things like that. But there can become a point to where your children will rebel. And since she is missing, you know, we have to look at that aspect, even if it's uncomfortable for the parents to accept the fact that we have to look at that.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have a computer in their house. And, you know, and it's not like they couldn't afford one. It's just they didn't want one in there because the mom said every time you turn on the TV, there was some pedophile who had lured somebody's child away via the internet. So she just didn't want that in her house. And, okay, I get that. And, but just not to even have one in the house, it was a little bit odd. And then she said, you know, Aisha's cautious and shy, the things that we've said before. And that she just thought, I never thought she would go out of the house. But that was in an interview that she did in 2013. She said, I thought that she would never go out of the house. But it's inconsistent. Like you said,
It is. It's a huge inconsistency because, you know, you always have parents that say, my child would never. Okay. But your children are latchkey kids. They're letting themselves in and out of the house all the time.
Yeah.
And she does go on to leave the house without you in the pitch black dark, in the storm, goes to a home that backs up to dogs. You said she's terrified. You know, she had to either smell them or see them. She knew they were there, especially if she took the bus route and that was her way of being familiar with the area. Just, I don't know, these little inconsistencies will always bother me. The fact when the child went missing, they immediately thought, okay, well, maybe she's just across the street. Again, that's putting the kid crossing over the street in the dark.
Latchkey kids are terribly independent, really.
Yes.
Because they are responsible for making their way home, whether it's, you know, on the, making their way onto the bus, if they're taking the bus, making their way off the bus, or oftentimes walking from school to home. And when they get home, taking care of, you know, getting a snack, doing all these kind of things, you know, staying inside the house, whatever, doing your homework. They're extremely responsible and independent because they don't have anybody looking over them for several hours. So,
right. It's a lot to mitigate. They have to come in and realize what type of snacks that they're allowed to make without burning the house down. You know, be it the Pop-Tart or a microwave dinner or something like that. You know, whatever the parents are allowing at the time. You're right. It's a ton of responsibility and it's a ton of stress on the parents. You know, that's why I believe her parents were so strict, you know, because they have laid all these laws down for them to just ensure that everything goes good and that the parents make it home. You know, they don't want to show up and have law enforcement at their home and taking away their kids and stuff because the kids have messed up the latchkey program.
So she was in fourth grade. And this, that weekend that she disappeared was actually a 3-day weekend. The schools were closed on that Friday before the Monday disappearance. So the parents had to work and the children spent the day at their aunt's house in the same neighborhood. So, you know, we've already established that grandma lives across the street and there's an aunt that lives with grandma. And now we have an aunt who has her own house and they're all right there. So they spend the day there. And then from there, the aunt, I guess, takes them to their youth basketball practice at the school. And then on Saturday, you have the basketball game. But it was the first game of the season. I understand the whole reaction about, oh, it's the playoffs or something like that. It's the last game of the season. Championship's on the line. Ugh, I screwed it up for everybody. It was the first game of the season.
Yeah, and she got that upset over the first game. So either it's just a child temper tantrum and she was on the verge of meltdown before that game even happened. You know, maybe she's just so wore out. You know how kids just start crying because they're tired. Or, you know, this is the buildup of something much bigger. You know, maybe it's not the game that really has her that emotional. It's some backstory. I question, you know, she spent a lot of time at these relatives' house that entire week leading up to her disappearance. Do they have computers in the home? Who's coming in and out of those homes? I understand that Aquila and her husband, they had a very tight ship at their home, right? No outsiders coming in and stuff. But what about these other houses?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can talk about yeah, so let's think about this for a second. Let's say mom and dad run this tight ship. And let's go back to the brother who I'm not going to look over that direction because I only see bad things. But maybe it's not only, maybe it's not seeing bad things at their own house. Maybe he's seeing bad things when they're staying in one of the relatives' houses.
Yeah, I mean, what is it about a bed squeaking that makes a child not want to turn over and look? Is it something as innocent as he can't be bothered? You know, is he that tired of his sister or has he heard this just too many times before? And I know that people, I've never even heard people discuss this outside of just trying to accuse the father. But what if, like you said, it's a great point. This sound is something that he's connecting to a different residence. You know, he just knows that sound and he just does not want to be a part of it at all. And that would cause a little girl to flee. You know, if she's constantly being abused, she's had enough. You know, she's emotional. You know, I just wonder what was going on in some of these homes that she had visited. Maybe not hers, but the other ones.
Yeah, because remember, this is the night after she spent the night at a relative's house.
Exactly. And we're coming out of her going to a big family reunion around a lot of people that she probably does not see all the time. You know, it's in Atlanta. Then right into a situation where she's back in North Carolina. She's around more of her relatives. You know, the mother and the father, they work a lot or it just they're not home. They're off doing something because it seems like there's a lot of family sitters involved.
Yeah. And so something could have happened that Saturday night when she's over at the relative's house, when she's over at grandma's house. I think that's where they stayed. When she's over at grandma's house that night, and she goes, I'm done. I'm out of here. You know, so then the next night when she's back at her house, she says, no more. I'm leaving.
This is a pattern, right? And she knows she's always got to go to these relatives' homes to have to keep getting babysat. Her parents are never going to stop working. She just sees in her head this pattern. It's never going to stop. The only way I can stop it is if I take myself out of the situation.
And it could have happened Friday when they were at a relative's house. And maybe that's why she was so upset Saturday at the game. And then Saturday night, maybe she was upset Saturday at the game because she knew she was going to go have to spend the night Saturday night at this same relative's house. And the same thing was going to happen to her. That's maybe why she was upset and not about a basketball game. And it seems as if in this family, I'm guessing that she probably didn't feel comfortable telling her parents about it.
Yeah, probably not. And the relatives may not feel comfortable telling the parents about some of the activities that the children participated in at their home. You know, they're not going to come out after a missing child and say, oh, well, by the way, I let her use the computer. Could you imagine? The parents would rain down so hard on them. You know, oh, I let her talk to, I don't know, this guy that I had over. You know, I don't see any of that in the investigative statements, unless they're holding back this whole just suite of evidence that they've never gave us. Just not seeing the right type of information. And I am sure that the FBI asked, you know, what type of people came in these homes? What do you have? You know, at least hopefully, right?
Yeah. So, like I said at the very, very beginning, one of the things I noticed is that there was clues that happened later. So, I guess it was a little bit more than a year after she disappeared. Construction workers found Aisha's book bag, and it was 30 miles from where she was last seen. And then many years after that, though, investigators released photos of a book and a shirt that were inside the bag to kind of get people, you know, spark this renewed interest. But when you say 30 miles from where she was last seen, that means a car, right?
Yeah, this is not something that could be traveled by a 9-year-old child on foot. And the bag was discovered by construction workers only after they were digging. So they were excavating an area ready to get ready to lay foundation, stuff like that. And they dig up this bag. And just out of curiosity, it's a trash bag, I guess. They haven't released photos of it. They open it. And inside is the child's book bag, and they go on to further unzip it. You know, curiosity kills the cat, and it has her name inside of it, you know, Aisha Degree. And the construction worker, I think at the time they didn't think anything of it and laid it to the side. But then the construction worker went home and told his wife, hey, we found this little child's book bag, and inside it had this name. And his wife said, oh my God, that's the little girl that was on the news. You have to call authorities. And then they turned the evidence over to the investigators, who started going through the bag and then telling Aisha's mom, you know, what was in it.
So we're going to go over some theories and stuff in a second, but I just want to go over this timeline really quick. So we have for sure, well, we don't know for sure. We have the dad saying that he checked on her at 2:30 in the morning. And then the truck driver says 3:15-ish is the time that he saw her on the highway, which is a lot different than 3:45 to 4:15. 3:15 says, because Aisha might not have had a clock in her room. So she's dad wakes up. She goes, wakes up, and she goes, oh, this is the time I got to go now or something. And they find the backpack in 2001 buried, like you said. And then in 2014, law enforcement said that they had a suspect, but it leads to another dead end. But that also shows that they were still working on it in 2014. And then in 2016, the FBI, because this is not like them, right? The FBI says, hey, she might have got into a car that night. An early 1970s Lincoln Mark IV or IV Thunderbird, dark green with rust around the wheel wells. That's pretty specific.
It's very specific. And if she was ducking and dodging other motorists, what made her approach this motorist? And this is where I'll go back to things that happened in her bedroom and what her brother did or did not see. If she was meeting this guy in the Thunderbird or, you know, whatever this green car is, it does seem very specific with the FBI. How did she know what time to meet him? You know, did they have a clock in their room? They claim that, you know, the little girl doesn't have a computer. She doesn't have a phone. Her brother doesn't mention hearing any alarm bells going off. how did she know what time to get up and go meet him? And then how does he, I'm assuming it's a he, how does the person know where to pick her up at? Because she's ducking and dodging in and out of woods. How did she know where she was, and how did this person know where she was?
Yeah, that doesn't...
I mean, if that's a planned thing, we're assuming that she didn't just run up to a motorist because she's been dodging them up until this point. How did they coordinate all of this? You know, no computer, parents say no pen pal, they're monitoring her every move. She can only have church friends, school friends, supposedly the parents know all of them. So who is this person?
Probably a relative. In 2018, this is something I kind of, so the FBI, well, it's actually the sheriff's office. They say that there was items found by the FBI, including Dr. Seuss' book, McKelligut's Pool, and a New Kids on the Block concert t-shirt. So these belong to her?
Yeah. Well, okay. So the book is a book that is from her school library. But the FBI will tell you that it is not exactly checked out to her. So this is where I start questioning the school and their records. You know, we'll never know if Aisha used a school computer or not, because they can't even keep up with their own library cards. The card in the back is supposedly not checked out to her. So either it was stolen, not filled in, or belongs to a different child who checked it out, whose name they're not releasing, and how it comes into Aisha's property, it's unknown. You know, the FBI is not talking about that. So that book is about, it's made by Dr. Seuss. It's about a child that goes on, or somebody goes on an adventure, right? So it's another runaway type book, and it inspired her, you know, maybe. But the New Kids on the Block shirt, I will never understand, because it's not popular with her 9-year-old age group. And it is a old school Ringer sleep shirt, like that you would have got from, I don't know, when the New Kids on the Block first arrived on the scene, and Aisha's mom does not, she doesn't remember it.
I mean, that's like 1988 or 89 or something like that. So
kind of like maybe that school photo that was found in the shed, you know, so it looks a little dated. So maybe that's a pairing, you know, that old school portrait that is not Aisha, and then this New Kids on the Block t-shirt. Because when you look at it, if you have ever followed New Kids on the Block, you're like, oh God, that's an old school. You can just tell it's vintage.
Yeah, so that is a very good point. Perhaps the New Kids on the Block concert teacher was in the shed, and she put it in the bag. Or did mom say that it came from her?
Is this some type of safe house for runaway kids? You know, like, what is going on with this shed? If there's already things in there that belong to other children, and then you have Aisha coming in and contributing her own things to it, how do they all know about that shed? You know, like, what type of... I wonder if they put surveillance on that area and... try to figure out like what's going on over there.
What did the mom say about the New Kids on the Block concert t-shirt, or we don't know?
She flat out said that is not hers. I have never seen that before. And they said, well, could it be something that was given to Aisha? And because for whatever reason, she would not have thought you wanted her to have it. Maybe she hid it from you, because kids will hide things from her parents. And then her, of course, her mother denied up and down that Aisha would never hide anything from her. But we know how it is. Plausible deniability. My kid would never. Yes, they would.
I don't know how it got in there. Because a New Kid's on the Block, I don't know.
It depends on where Aisha had been, you know, relative's house, you know, traveling like crazy up and to the point of her disappearance. Who knows when she stuck that in her bag?
Now, one of the things that I know is of interest to you in this is that because she was wearing white, all white, it's kind of, it makes you stand out. Right. And it makes you visible. It makes witnesses notice you.
It does. So if it's a planned thing, why would you wear all white? If you're trying to be in a clandestine situation, you don't want to be visible to the public. You know, why that color of all colors? You know, is it something to wear of, you know, it's a grooming situation, abduction situation. They're like, I need you to wear all white so I can see you, because this is literally the darkest highway. The only way you're seeing anything is if your headlights just happen to see it, and they picked the perfect night, whoever planned this, because stormy nights make for the best crimes. You know, the visibility is exceptionally poor, and it's loud. You know, they probably never heard her ducking out of the house, because you've got the rain and the wind.
That's true. But also
it is perfect.
But I also, the dad doesn't seem to sleep, right? I know that you said, okay, he's got to go out for stuff for the anniversary and everything. And yes, I know it's the age of Walmart where Walmarts are open 24 hours and things, but it just seems like an odd time to go to Walmart, 3 o'clock in the morning.
It does, unless this family was up at this time of night all the time. You know, is this a family that just does not sleep because, you know, the brother's up because he hears the child, you know, the mom must have been up. The dad's up apparently because he works the night shift. You know, it just family dynamics are important.
So if everybody's up, they're going to notice you're leaving.
You would think I know that Aisha knew her parents' schedule, but who else knew it? Because like you said, it's the perfect opportunity to where you had to hit the window just right. You needed to miss your father. If he's not involved in this and another relative's not involved in this, you have to hit the window where he's either out of the home or you know for a fact that he's not going to peek his head back in your door and catch you.
Okay, so let me ask you this. You mentioned it briefly. When the construction workers found the bag, and I want to make sure that everybody got this, that it was in a bag. It was double bagged. This was not just, hey, we dug it up and there was the backpack. This was not, we just dug it up and there was one bag. This person double bagged it. And
this is incredibly odd for any type of evidence, because if you have an abduction scene, you know, I don't believe the child could have dug the backpack in that deep. So you have some type of third party, right? Or second party. So you have it double bagged, which screams preservation. If you had abducted a child or in any type of kidnapping situation, why would you preserve anything that you think people would find later? Unless, is this a compromise? You've got her. She's packed this bag full of all her favorite things. She is a very emotional child. Was it where it's like, I need you to lose these things. We've got to leave them here. And then she throws down and he's like, he, she, whatever. You know, I'll make a deal with you. We'll put it in this bag so it won't get messed up, but we got to bury it. I mean, that's the only logical thing. Why else would you bury it unless the person is going to go back and dig it up and then, like, I don't know, love on it because, you know, killers keep trophies and things like that. It's disgusting, but it's what they do. But that area, it was already set up for construction. You know, they knew it would eventually be developed. So why there?
Well, I think that it's really interesting that you said that killers are the ones that double bag it because they want to dig up the trophy later and relive the fantasy. Who else would, I don't know. If I was burying something, I would just bury it. I wouldn't think to put it in a bag and bury it. I wouldn't think to double bag it and bury it. So, is this somebody that was a killer who had been through this before?
Well, the thing is that with the trophy killers, they usually put their trophies on their own property or at least in their own storage lockers, places that are easily accessible to them. This land, you know, like who's involved in this? Like, why did the person who was with Aisha choose this set of land? It's just the oddest thing because they knew that it was going to be eventually dug up. They knew it would get found. To me, if you're looking to make it out of the county very quickly with a kid, it's dark. None of you can see. You're just going to go up to a place and just say, look, we just need to hurry. We need to bury this. We need to get rid of it. You've got a child that's combative. She doesn't want to let go of her stuff. And you're like, okay, we'll double bag it and we'll come back and get it later. And it seems like a child of 9 would probably buy that.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than throwing it in a dumpster, I guess. And maybe they thought, well, if we double bag it in trash bags, that whoever does find it will just throw it away and not open it.
My only hope is that if it was a compromise and she was still alive at that point, you know, and whoever went on to help her concoct this runaway situation or grooming situation, you know, the purpose is unknown, but it seems like if it was a compromise, at least she would be alive at this point. If she was being combative or he or she didn't want to hurt her feelings, then they're negotiating with a kid, which again, it's super odd. And that's why this is in my top 10. It's just full of things that are extremely odd that you don't see in cases all the time.
Well, this shed, I mean, you couldn't see it from the road, right? From the highway?
No, because there's a wood line.
Okay. But this is the way that she would go to and from school, right? On the bus?
Yeah, both the back of the wood line and then the front also, I believe, a school bus runs through there.
So if somebody could have said, hey, meet at the upholstery place or whatever, she might know where it is because she passes it all the time and knows how to get there. So it could have been a meeting point. And she could have, you know, maybe this guy who was driving down the road said, you know, I circled around and she went off into the woods. Maybe that was her plan all along because she knew that that's where the upholstery place was, right on the other side of the woods.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if the person told her, you know, try to find this building, you know, and I'll pick you up there.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it kind of makes you wonder about the FBI's theory of her being picked up from the actual highway and put into a green vehicle. See, those things, they don't go together.
No, they don't. And that Dr. Seuss book they're talking about, I mean, it's about running off an adventure on an adventure.
Yeah, and in the same breath, we just have to mention that also in her school class, they were reading a book about the whipping boy, I don't know, a prince that has a lackey, and they run away from the king and get into all this kind of trouble, and, you know, they find themselves through adventure. So these two different books that are centered around, you know, pretty similar plots of people who are leaving everything they know to discover something better and then coming back a more fully, I don't know, just fully round person. You know, just more diverse and stuff like that. I don't know how much of a 9-year-old, like, how much can they pick up from a book like that other than just the sound of adventure?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's dark and stormy. Is that really when a child would go and find adventure? I'm not so sure.
No. If she really is afraid of dogs and, you know, her mom thinks that, but maybe she has changed and her mom just has the same opinion. You know, maybe something happened when Aisha was 4 or 5, but now she's 9 and she likes dogs just fine. Because I find it hard to believe that none of the relatives had a dog and where she's staying all the time.
I'm on board with that. I think her mother remembers her a certain way. I just think you made a very valid point. You know, these are ideas that are probably from when she was 5 or 6. And you know how you have a fear of something and then you outgrow it. I don't think this kid's afraid of the dark, the rain, dogs. She probably loves dogs by now because all of these things go on to be in her story and, you know, she continues on.
Yeah. And so let's say, okay, she's not afraid of the dogs. She's not afraid of the storms. I still don't get the whole thing about not wearing a coat. That kind of, you know, strange to me. If she was groomed, this is a person that was very good at it. This is not somebody that, you know, like a relative or somebody who's just stumbling. This is somebody who's really, really good.
This is almost professional because her lack of communication with, if it's not a relative, with, let's say, outsiders, the window is so small. So this would have to be one smooth operator to the point of where it is scary and you worry if there is going to be other victims if it's something like that. But I just want to point out that her parents, they try to, I call it infantile, the victim here, their daughter. They want you to look for her. They want you to believe that she did not run away on her own. They want you to wipe those thoughts from your mind so that the public will look for her. You know, that they want people to think, you know, it's definitely a crime involved. You know, she's scared of dogs. She's scared of this. She's scared of that. They're just driving the point home any way they can to try to get the public to look. And it's like, look, we will look. Like, I wanted to go up there on foot and look for her myself. Like, this story, it really touched my heart. So I do think that she was coerced or groomed in some form or fashion or got herself into something that she didn't fully understand.
Now, again, you know, how did she find the shed? But I think you've answered that. I think that, you know, she was driven past it every day and stuff like that. I mean, yes, it's a little ways from her home. You know, the parents said, well, you know, she's only allowed around church people and school friends that her parents knew. But again, you can't control what your kid is doing for multiple hours every single day when you're not there. And you're going home, you know, she's going home to her own house. So it wouldn't probably take very long for, you know, if she goes home and then, oh, you know, I want to go see grandma, goes across the street. It's this little community with all her relatives. They also probably know that Aisha and her brother are home alone every single afternoon. And, oh, you know, she gets introduced to somebody. It's not a stretch. It is not like she's just going straight home every day, just straight home and not seeing any of these other relatives who don't know anything. And who's, you know, and she's not leaving the house because she is leaving the house.
Yeah, so, it's family self-preservation to where they want you to believe, you know, that we're good people, we raised a good family, we care about our kids, you know, we're close and things like that. And it's like, okay, we get it. But at the end of the day, you know, don't stretch the truth. They are latchkey kids. They are quite independent. They are exposed to a lot of different people, you know, that are outsiders, because you never know who is at all of these different relatives' homes. They did travel prior to her going missing, you know, completely out of state. So it's not off the table that she wasn't exposed to someone that she was not normally around. Like you said, you can't control every single moment of their day. And what she did at school, we'll never fully know because of the library book. You know, it's a record that has an error in it. So how many other errors does the school contain? Who knows?
Yeah. She locked the front door behind herself, which is interesting. And it shows that that's just kind of a habit. Okay, when we go to school, we got to lock the door or whatever, or come home. And so here's a theory for you. She was fleeing dad, and he caught up to her, and that's why they were both out during the middle of the night.
Yeah, I will wonder if they got into it, you know, like again, with the squeaky bed, the boy not wanting to look and stuff like that. I mean, yes, I have to put everything on the table until it is absolutely 100% rolled out. And they can't roll out the parents. There's nothing to say the parents are involved, but there is nothing to indefinitely prove that they're not either. So it's still on the table. You know, did the girl flee and did dad catch up to her? Because again, they're all up. That has been a theory that has been, you know, just kind of like in the background. You know, one of the lesser, you know, I call it less good theories, but it's still a theory.
I call it less good, not because I don't think that, you know, a relative could do that or a dad. It's the shed thing throws that off for me a little bit.
Yeah.
Because she obviously spent some time in this shed, and was he just driving around and driving around and driving around trying to find her?
Well, and, I mean, obviously, because she was in there long enough, right, to start peeling open candy and making herself kind of at home. And, you know, she's starting to eat. That's what kids do. They sit down and they start trying to enjoy something. And she's pulling things out of her backpack. She goes on to leave them, which makes you wonder if she got out of there in a hurry. You know, she didn't have time to collect those items and put them back into her backpack.
And the mom called the dad before calling the police or anything. So that was six. Where was the dad where she was able to call him? Was he at work? Because this is 2000. I mean, yeah, I mean, people, obviously you got cell phones, but
where would she call him? He was home. He saw the kids in their bed asleep. Then he goes out to get, you know, different mementos for Valentine's Day and the anniversary. Where did she call him? At Walmart?
Yeah, because, you know, with 2000, we're talking Nokias maybe or something like that. And so not everybody had a cell phone. And I don't know. It just,
yeah, that, I don't know about the late night call, but the calls that she went on to make in the morning were from her house phone to the relatives. Yeah. And then she physically walked across the street to those relatives' homes to try to find her daughter.
She ran away, but ran into a bad guy along the way. Possible?
I mean, yeah. I mean, of course it's plausible because we have no idea what happened to her, but where was she going? What was her destination? She packs his bag. They never said anything about recovering a map. Where was she going?
Maybe she thought, hey, I'm going to try and walk to school today. I mean,
okay,
that's...
but her parents are so strict that they are just smothering her to death. Can you imagine the repercussion of getting caught, having snuck out of the house, getting caught on a highway in the middle of the night? So dangerous. You would flip your parents, just twist them inside out. The punishment would be severe. They pull you out, likely pull you off the basketball team. I don't know if they spanked or what their punishment was in the house, but I would imagine that she was very familiar with it and did not want a part of that.
Yeah. And then there's the the theory that perhaps she was sold to traffickers or something, because she'd be, what'd she be now, like?
In her 20s?
Yeah, almost 30.
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it's been that long. But yeah, she was at the perfect age for, unfortunately, human trafficking. And that area does have human trafficking. Yeah. So can't rule that off the table either. Again, you know, you never know what relatives, distant relatives can get up to, what they have in mind. Some people view humans as just walking cash symbols. You know, you can sell a human over and over and over again, and some people will.
So let's say she was sold to traffickers, and she's 30 now. Obviously, the problem I have with that is she would have at some point got in touch with her parents, I would imagine. And
they don't keep, we know this, they don't keep you past a prime number. So there is no way. You know, it's like the Amy Bradley story where people believe that she could be, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 and still out there, I don't know, being a madam somewhere. It's like, no, once you're past your prime, if she was even in a trafficking situation, they're going to end you. So unfortunately, you know, we would be looking for, you know, they are looking for a body, anything that remotely brings this child home alive or deceased. But you'd be looking for a body harder at this point.
I mean, that's just,
it's just, where do you look, you know, because the FBI didn't really come in due to state lines or anything like that. It's because it's a child missing at a tender age.
That's why they came in, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, they haven't actually said how we suspect the parents or anything like that. And all I know about what happened in the 2014 or whatever was that they thought that they had a suspect, but then they didn't. Do you know anything about that at all?
Okay, so there was an inmate that had penned a letter to an editor and also to someone that worked in the jail system, you know, corrections system or something like that. It was during COVID, during lockdown, when people were not going in and interviewing inmates. People weren't really talking to each other, period. You know, it was hard to get a sit down with anyone. But this inmate who was facing a lengthy sentence came forward and said, I know what happened to that little 9-year-old girl in North Carolina, and you definitely need to talk to me. And investigators, they thought, you know, this guy's not trustworthy. You know, he's just trying to get us to lengthen his sentence, or he wants to trade out or whatever. And they listened to what he had to say. And go ahead. Tell him.
No, well, they listened and then they said, no, there's nothing to it at all.
Basically try to say that the little girl was hit by a hit and run driver, and then her stuff was buried due to that fact. And the thing is that, again, it's pouring down rain, low visibility. The person would have had to have got out there with a broom and a flashlight. I mean, hell, a floodlight, and cleaned up this horrible crime scene. There would have been stuff everywhere because the little girl would have been wearing the backpack. It would have showed damage consistent with a vehicle accident. What the FBI dug up does not appear to have any type of vehicle accident signatures. So I take it that it was preserved nicely.
And do you think that she's alive?
At this point in time, sadly, no.
Yeah.
For a little bit, if she was groomed, yes.
Yeah.
For a couple of years, it's very likely. I mean, look, little Cleo just came home in Australia. So they will keep you for a little while. And then once they're done and you've served your purpose, unfortunately, these monsters will get rid of you. Because to me, it comes across as just a grooming situation and a child that did not realize the implications of what it is that she was getting into.
Yeah, I kind of think that too. I don't see how she's alive. We'll both say that she's probably dead. Number two, was she taken by a relative or somebody that was kind of professionally grooming her?
Since her line of communication, that the window is so small, she had no computer or anything like that, it needed to be someone that had access to her. So a relative of some sort, you know, whether they were coming over to another relative's house, I'm always very suspicious of the family reunion, because that would bring in people from, I guess, other states, or at least other, you know, people that she was not around all the time. I'm sure, oh, this is your great, great, great grandmother's uncle, yeah. Or you know how family reunions are. They can bring in anyone. And then as the family goes on to marry, you're bringing in strangers, you know, this is her new husband, whatnot. That she could have been exposed to a lot of new people. So I'll always go back to the family reunion, and then also who was at the other relatives' homes.
Yeah, I'm going to go with relative. I am. And I mean, I know that the FBI or the sheriff had a good reason for the car thing.
Yes, but they never said it wasn't a relative or that it couldn't have been linked to a family reunion. We have no plate. So if it is an out-of-state plate, you know, someone that drove up from Georgia or Mississippi or one of those areas of someone who attended the reunion, you know, they're not going to tell us that. They tell you just enough to get you to call in and help them continue to piece things together without spooking the actual person or drying up a lead that they're following.
Totally agree. Well, hopefully at some point we will know something, not only for her and, you know, the family, but also for you, so you can find a new white whale. And
yeah. But you know what's weird, just before we end this, is that, you know, she disappeared Valentine's Day, the 3-day weekend, you know, where kids just happen to be out of school. And also you have Delphi, 3-day weekend, kids just happen to be out of school, Valentine's Day. I didn't plan that in my white whale series of toppers, but, you know, they have that in common. So,
well, one of these weeks we're going to have to go over your entire top 10 list. So,
oh, okay. I'm there for that.
Okay. Just we'll go over all your top 10 from number 10 to number one. Maybe we'll do that next week.
Okay. I'm game.
All right. Well, I hope that you have a great weekend. Jen, I hope that you have a wonderful weekend too. Congratulations to your Braves for winning the World Series.
How about that? Look at that. Yeah. Since the early 90s. And here they are again. I'm so excited. The parade was, it started at 12 on the East Coast, and went and looked at a little bit of that. So just exciting times, right?
Yes, it is. So I'm happy for you. It's always nice when your team wins a world championship. So
absolutely. So go Braves. Good job. And everyone stay safe. And until next time.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye.